The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Tom Hunter. I'm obviously not Sebastian Younger, so you're probably wondering why I'm up here. When Sebastian came to the Coringall Valley, I was actually stationed there with Battle Company, 2nd of 503rd. So, you know, we got to talking a few times over there, and, you know, it's basically how we know each other. I'm actually in the book, if you own a copy, page 38, if you want to double-check that. But, yeah, I was sent up here to introduce Sebastian simply because he wrote this book, and I was able to read most of it on my trip up to New York last week to see him, basically open this book for his book tour. And in reading it, you know, I told him this when I saw him last week, but I'll say it again so that you can all, you know, fathom how accurate of a depiction this book actually is. If we possess the intelligence or the ability to write the way that he can write and put those words to paper and, you know, put them in a book, then it would be this book. It would be the book War. He captures every day, every morning, every night, every aspect of that conflict in that small portion of Afghanistan, and he captures it beautifully. It's on point, 100%. And that's my introduction. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Sebastian.
Thank you. I'll bring you up to the
Q&A. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight. It's a real honor to be introduced by one of the guys who was out there. Hold on. So my idea for this book, I've covered Afghanistan for years, since 1996. Most of the time was I was with the civilian population. I was with Ahmad Shah Massoud in the north while his forces were fighting the Taliban in 2000. He was assassinated right before 9/11. I went back and I was with his men when they took Kabul with the help of the U.S. Air Force. I remember getting walking around in Kabul after it was liberated, and that was how the Afghans referred to that time, the liberation of Kabul. Walking around the streets, and people would, strangers would find out that I was American, and they would literally come up to me and hug me because I was American, and they were so grateful for being rid of the Taliban regime. It made a big impression on me. It was, at that point, a very easy war. The Taliban toppled in a few weeks. More journalists were killed covering that than American soldiers. It was very, very easy. Something like 90% of Afghans were for the American action that toppled the Taliban. The level of support was incredible. Nobody thought, I don't think anyone thought, that from that point on the war would be so filled, not with mistakes, but with lack of manpower, lack of support, lack of resources. There was something like 15,000 American soldiers in Afghanistan for several years after 9/11. There's around 40,000 cops in New York City. Clearly, that wasn't going to work. And now here we are today with a real fight on our hands. What I wanted to do, as the years went by and I realized that this country that I had not quite adopted but become very interested in journalistically and really cared about, that country and my own country were now inextricably involved, and American soldiers were going over there for deployment after deployment, and casualties were mounting, and I wanted to do something I'd never done before, which was be a journalist, but not with the civil population, but with soldiers, American soldiers. I knew nothing about the U.S. military, absolutely nothing. I'm not from a military family. I didn't have any friends who went into the military. So I really was a blank slate. And so I started, I was put with Battle Company of the 173rd Airborne, a really within the military known as an extraordinary unit. And they were in the Korangal Valley in Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan. I didn't know this. They didn't even know this, but Korangal, 6 miles long, was an incredibly important valley to the Taliban because they fought for it very, very hard. While I was there, something like a fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan, 70,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan, and a fifth of the combat was being absorbed by the 150 men of battle company in those 6 miles. They were in something like 500 firefights during their deployment, 400 and something. They didn't know that that was going to happen. I mean, the guys that I was with in 2nd Platoon, Tom was in 1st Platoon, so I didn't spend a huge amount of time with him. But in the guys in 2nd Platoon, who I got to know extremely well, they said their big worry when they were headed over there was that there wasn't going to be any combat. They joined the Army voluntarily. They had to work very hard to get into a combat infantry unit, and every single person in that unit was at least accepting of the idea of combat, if not actively curious about it. And their worry was that they were going to sit around and be bored for a year. That definitely did not happen. I did five one-month trips out there. My idea was to write a book about what it's like emotionally to be a soldier in combat. I had no broader agenda than that. I have plenty of opinions and interest in the wider politics of the war, in the rights and wrongs of it, in the mistakes. And I could talk for hours about that, but that wasn't the point of the book. The point of the book was to explain what it's like to be a soldier in combat. And so when I went out there, I didn't really ask the soldiers about political questions or anything. They never really sat around talking about politics. So my book is absolutely devoid of that important discussion, but that discussion for me happens elsewhere. Every guy out there that I knew was almost killed at one point or another, or in multiple occasions. Not almost killed in a kind of abstract sense, like, well, we were in a war zone, of course, you know, in a very specific way, like guys would show me bullet holes in their uniforms from rounds that had cut through the fabric and not touched them. I was having a nice conversation with someone one morning, and, well, just to back up for a second, the really bizarre thing about bullets is that they travel much faster than sound. So if someone shoots at you from several hundred meters, you don't hear the gunfire at first. The way you know you're getting shot at, if someone's shooting at you from a distance, is this really bizarre snapping sound. And it's the sound of, you know, bullets breaking the sound barrier past your head. But it's pretty subtle sound. So when the soldiers would get hit, the first thing that happened was everyone would kind of look around like, wait, did you hear that? Like, what was that? There was always a moment of confusion, like, wait, was that the snapping sound? And then you'd hear the gunfire. But there was always this sort of moment of delay. So one morning, I was having a conversation with someone. I was leaning against a HESCO, which are these big barriers that they, like, wire barriers that they fill with dirt. They're like huge sandbags, and they make fortifications out of them. They fill them by hand. So I was leaning against a HESCO up at this outpost and talking with someone, and some dirt flew in my face. Out of nowhere. I was like, what was that? And then, you know, a second later I heard da-da-da-da, and it was the first round of the first burst of a firefight that lasted almost an hour. You know, that was some number of inches from my head. I don't know how many. I was blown up. I was in a Humvee that was blown up. The explosion went off under the engine block instead of under the crew compartment, and so we were all okay physically. But everyone had those stories, and if you went out there for any length of time as a reporter, you had them too. I heard in the deployment after the one I was with, a reporter got two bullets in the chest and stopped by his plate. It was a very, very dangerous place. I was with 2nd Platoon, about 35 men. After about midsummer, there was a lot of combat. They were starting to take a lot of casualties, and the enemy was using the high ground, south of the main base, the Korangal outpost, the COP, as they called it, to shoot down into the position. The enemy would climb up onto the ridge lines and shoot down into the COP. So it's called plunging fire. It's very effective. And so the command decided to put an outpost on that high ground that they were getting shot at from. They were going to take it away from the enemy. They were just going to put an outpost there. So one night, two platoons of men walked up the spur with picks and shovels and their weapons, and they got there, and they started and sandbags, and they started hacking away at the rock. There was no sand up there, unfortunately. They had to hack away at the rock with pickaxes and fill sandbags. They called them rock bags and pile them up, and they dug furiously all night long to create a defensive position because they knew they were going to get attacked in the morning. I mean, this was basically the enemy's favorite place, and the battle company was taking it away from them. So dawn came, and they got hit immediately, and for the next 24 hours, they alternated working and fighting. They were in 13 firefights that day. They would work until they started taking fire, and they'd throw down their tools and grab their guns and start shooting back. They said the fighting was easier because it was very hot. It was midsummer. They could lie down and drink water while they shot and sort of rest a little bit, and then the firing would die down. They'd get up, and they'd go back to work. They did that for 24 hours straight. The outpost was called Restrepo. It was named after the platoon medic who was killed in the second month of the deployment, a really beloved guy. He was originally from Colombia, and he played guitar. He was just an incredibly great guy, and his loss was devastating to everybody. So Restrepo, it was a two-hour walk from the main base. There was no running water out there, so the men couldn't bathe. They basically would live in their clothes for a month at a time, and then once a month they'd switch out down to the COP, and they'd get a shower. There was no internet or phone at Restrepo, so they could call their girlfriend or their wife down at the COP for a couple of days. They'd get a hot meal, and after a few days they'd walk back out to Restrepo for another month. It was incredibly isolated out there, and it was a small position. There was 15 to 20 men out there, and there were days when I was out there that the position would be attacked four or five times in one day. I mean, not just like a little, sniper round or two, but a really full-on fight. And it was a very, very vulnerable position in some ways because it was small and it was absorbing much of the combat for the entire valley. And the valley itself was absorbing much of the combat for the entire area. One of the reasons they put the American positions in there was because, I mean, not that the Coringal itself was hugely important. It's a six-mile-long dead-end valley with a few thousand Afghans living in it. And the Afghans weren't even sure, I was told this, that at first some of the older Afghans weren't even sure if we were, American soldiers or Russian soldiers. Like, they, weren't clear about it. It was pretty amazing. The Pesh River Valley, just to the north, was very important. It was a major mobility corridor. There was a lot of agriculture, a lot of commerce, a big population. The Americans were building a trade school there to educate the young Afghans in trade, in the trades. And the Taliban were attacking the Pesh very, very heavily. It was a very dangerous road. And when they were using the Coringal as sort of a launch pad for these attacks. So when they put the American base into the Coringal, the attacks on the Pesh stopped, and that was a very good thing. That was a very important valley, and the Coringal absorbed almost all of it. So it's hard not to describe Restrepo as just miserable. And yet it wasn't, but I'll get to that part. But first for the miserable part. There's tarantulas up there and scorpions and snakes, and it was incredibly hot in the summer. It was incredibly cold in the winter. There was no connection with the outside world. There was no way to bathe. For a while, there was no electricity. They built some plywood hooches and got some gasoline heaters in there for the winter. it was a very, very rough place. In my book, I say it was a kind of anti-paradise. There was no women out there, obviously. There was no alcohol. There was no television. All the things that young men entertained themselves with were absent out there, and people were trying to kill them. When there was a lot of combat, things in a weird way, things were fine, because combat is pretty, whatever the pluses and minuses of combat are, it's a pretty engaging thing to have to do. The boredom out there in the lulls between the fighting was very, very hard on the men. And one of the ways they got through it was with humor. They were incredibly funny. They were intentionally funny, I think. They really, I think, were reverted to a kind of old human tradition of storytelling. They didn't have any other form of entertainment, and they would just sit around and watch the clouds go by. You know, this is on quiet days, you know, and if it was hot, everything was sort of slowed down. So someone would say something, and then there'd just be silence for like 5 minutes, and then like someone would answer. And then there'd be silence for 5 minutes, and then someone would say something else. So these incredibly slow motion conversations, and they were very, very funny with each other. And one of the real pleasures for me of going out there was that it was just such a show. I mean, the guys were just so entertaining. So I'm going to read a little section that speaks to that. Mid-afternoon, and we're sitting in the shade of concealment netting that's been draped over the courtyard. I mean, it's not a courtyard. There was the center of the outpost. The outpost was about the size of this room, basically. There hasn't been a firefight in weeks, and the men are getting a little weird. Disputes with a strange new edge to them and a sullen tension that doesn't bode well for the coming months. April is supposed to be the start of fighting season, and the fact that nothing has happened yet produces a cruel mix of boredom and anxiety. If the men were getting hammered, at least they'd have something to do, but this is the worst of both worlds, all the dread and none of the adrenaline. A visiting medic named Doc Shelkey is talking about the Hindu religion, and Abdul, the Afghan interpreter, happens to overhear him. "Hindu is bullshit," he says. Shelkey looks like he might be from India. He maintains his calm. "The last time a Terp," the Terp was the slang for interpreter, "the last time a Terp said something like that, I talked shit about Islam until he cried," he says. It was a stupid thing for Abdul to say, and he doesn't speak English well enough to make this a fair fight or even interesting. In an attempt to head off another hour of boredom, O'Byrne weighs in on his own religious views. O'Byrne was a major character in the book and a guy that I'm very close to. He was the only guy in the platoon to get out of the army. He's now a civilian and a good friend of Tom's. O'Byrne weighs in with his own religious views. "I don't believe in heaven or hell, and I don't want an afterlife," he says. "I believe in doing good in your life, and then you die. I don't believe in God, and I've never read the Bible. I don't believe in that because I don't want to." An awkward silence. Another sergeant says something irrelevant about an upcoming patrol. "What? The conversation gets serious and you change the subject?" O'Byrne says. "We're talking about religion. You can't have a half-assed conversation about religion." More silence. No one knows what to say. "Mommy hit Daddy and then Daddy hit Mommy," a private finally tries. The guys are experts of a sort at being funny, and they seem to go out of their way to be. Maybe it's the only way to stay sane up there. Not because of the combat, you're never saner than when your survival is in question, but because of the unbelievable screaming boredom. And I apologize, the language is a bit salty in this book, I apologize. I cleaned it up as much as I could. "Okay, who's gonna die today?" was a standard one-liner before patrols. One of the guys was named Anderson, and he got a lot of that because, tragically, two other Andersons had died in the valley in previous deployments. So Anderson, the current Anderson, the guys were like, "Man, forget it. You're not making it. I mean, you might as well give me your laptop now because you're not getting out of this valley." "Anderson, what do you want on your tombstone?" I heard someone ask before we all headed down to Karangal. "Now that's messed up," Anderson muttered as he put on his helmet. Before patrols, guys promised their laptops to each other or their new boots or their iPods. One pair of friends had a serious agreement that if one of them should die, the other would erase all the porn on his laptop before the army could ship it back to his mom. Mothers were an irresistible, and my apologies to the moms out there, mothers were an irresistible source of humor. If I start banging your mom when we get home, will that make me your dad? Or some version of that was pretty much boilerplate humor at Restrepo. Once I watched O'Byrne grab someone's ass and give it a good deep squeeze. When the man demanded an explanation, O'Byrne said, "I'm just trying to get an idea what your mom's ass is going to feel like when we get home." Only wives and girlfriends are off limits because the men are already so riddled with anxiety over what's going on back home that almost nothing you could say would be funny. Anything else, mothers, sisters, retarded nephews, is fair game. I think one of the things they were doing, I don't say this explicitly in the book, really, I don't, a little bit, but it was such a remarkable thing that they were, they were saying things that really would get you killed in a lot of bars in this country, and they were doing it on purpose. And I think what was going on was that they all needed each other out there. Their lives all depended on everyone else. And the willingness to run through gunfire to save someone's life is a pretty profound commitment to that other person. And I think what some of that humor was demonstrating is, look, I'm going to say the worst thing possible to you, and you're going to overlook it. And only the best of friends would do that. And anything less than that, and you'd kill me. And so I'm going to say these terrible things about your mom, and you're going to just smile or whatever. And that's the way we show each other that there's nothing we can do to threaten the commitment we have to each other. And that commitment really was about what happens in combat. Is everyone willing to risk their lives to help everyone else? Not all the humor involved gutting your best friend's personal dignity. Donahoe would pretend to see obstacles on night patrols and climb over them so he could watch the next guy in line try to do the same thing. Money ate a 2-pound bag of tuna in one sitting just to see what would happen. O'Byrne and Sergeant Al fashioned a tarantula out of pipe cleaners to slip into my sleeping bag. I eventually became part of this. I made the huge mistake, and if you're ever with a platoon of combat infantry, don't make this mistake, I've had a terrible phobia of spiders since I was a little kid. If you're phobic about anything and you're with the infantry, don't tell them. Because they, you know, of course, you know, boys being boys, tarantulas being tarantulas, they'd pick the tarantulas up and throw them at each other. I mean, who wouldn't, right? And so, I was like, okay, guys, just so that you know, I'm really scared of spiders. So just when it comes to throwing the tarantulas, just don't throw them at me. And terrible, terrible error of judgment. But then they thought, well, wait a minute. He's like a million years. I was 45 at the time. He's like a million years old. And they couldn't even fathom how old I was, right? He's like a million years old, and he looks like he's in pretty good shape. But what happens if we give him a heart attack? What if we kill the reporter? So they decided to they would build a fake tarantula, and there's limited materials out there. So I know something's up. There's just a strange energy, right? I felt like a parent, and like the kids, you know, like something's going on downstairs with the kids, you know. And I was like, something's gonna happen tonight. And I heard them outside the hooch, and it was Brendan and O'Byrne and Sergeant Al. And one of them goes, "I know, we can use pipe cleaners." And I was like, pipe cleaners? It just didn't sit right in my mind. And I'm sitting in my little bunk, and it's really tight squeeze. I mean, there's like, you can touch someone's bunk, you know, three other bunks with your hand. I mean, it's like very, very tight in these little plywood hooches that they built. And I was like, no one's been that excited about pipe cleaners since like second grade. pipe cleaners. And then I was like, oh, of course. They're fuzzy, and they're furry, and they're flexible. I mean, they make perfect tarantula legs, right? I was like, I got it. I was like, oh, they're building a tarantula. So I put on my clothes in case I had to, like, run out the door, and put on my boots and sat there reading my book and sort of waited for them to come in with, like, whatever thing they constructed. It ended up going into my sleeping bag the next day. But anyway, All the joking around aside, it was pretty miserable out there, and it was extremely dangerous. And everyone out there lost a good friend at one point or another. The very real trauma that the guys experienced when they came home, quite a lot of that wasn't from having almost gotten killed or whatever. It was the loss of their friends, and not just the loss of a friend. I mean, imagine being in high school and your best friend is killed. That would mess up anybody. In this situation, your best friend is killed in front of you. The equivalent would be, two 18-year-olds walking down the street in their hometown, and one of them's taken out by a car in front of his buddy. That's what happens in combat. That's why combat is so painful. And I think it's why, this is a complete theory of mine, I don't know, but I think it's one of the reasons that soldiers really have a hard time, are very reluctant to talk about combat with civilians, with other people. It's not that combat itself is hard to talk about. It's pretty interesting. It's a pretty intense endeavor. But you lose best friends in combat. So if soldiers talk about best friends, if soldiers talk about combat, inevitably they're talking about the very upsetting deaths of good friends of theirs. And that makes them cry. And guys don't like to cry in front of other people. I mean, I think some of it really comes down to that. Like, look, I start telling you about, my year in the Korangal Valley, and then I start thinking about Restrepo, and then I have a lump in my throat, and now suddenly I'm at the dinner table crying, and I don't want to do that. So I think, Tom can, can comment on this later, but I think one of the reasons that soldiers are so infamously reluctant to talk about that stuff is not that it's not interesting to them. It's that it triggers an emotional reaction, which they just don't want to deal with a year later, 20 years later, whatever it may be. So Brendan O'Byrne, Brendan was from a pretty troubled background. There was a lot of alcohol abuse in his childhood and the people around him. In some ways, he was on a very self-destructive course when he was a teenager. He joined the Army kind of in the nick of time, and the Army kind of saved him from whatever he was going to do to himself as a civilian, which probably wasn't going to be pretty. But it was pretty rough out there, and he decided to get out of the Army. So he ended up being on the East Coast, and we're very good friends. He's a very thoughtful, sort of contemplative person. He was a really good soldier. And he thought a lot about what they were doing. And he really turned it over in his mind, what it means to risk your life, what it means to kill other people. He just thought about these things in ways that I think the other guys were, but they weren't putting words to their thoughts. Brendan was. So for a journalist, talking to Brendan was a very valuable experience. And he and I became very close. And so afterwards, we continued our friendship. And a couple of months ago, actually, I invited him to a dinner party that my wife and I were giving, and a friend of ours, a woman about 40 years old, knew what Brendan had been through, and asked him, "Is there anything that you miss about being out there?" And Brendan, without a shred of irony, said, "I miss almost all of it." And I really had this. He said that, and I thought about it. It's such an extraordinary thing to say. And what I realized in my book, this happened just recently. My book is basically an attempt to explain to civilians what he meant, what it was that he missed out there. Because it's not an obvious proposition, you take a young man, you almost kill him, you kill his best friends, you put him out on a hilltop without anything for a year, and you bring him back to the pleasures of society. Everything that young men like. And after a kind of boozy few weeks, he's like, "Oh, I wish I could go back." What is it that's not happening in society that he feels he needs, that he would risk his life in order to get? What is it that's happening out there that makes him feel fulfilled and complete and meaningful? It's an important question. Sometimes I had the feeling that the it was a weird kind of social experiment. Like, you take 20 guys and you put them on a hilltop without any outside anything and no women and just see what happens. And I had the feeling that, like, because they didn't have to put up a front for anybody because there was no one to put up a front for. It was just them on that hilltop. So you really got to see, I felt like you really got to kind of peer into the male brain in a strange way. And one of the really interesting things that I saw in the male brain was the way they negotiated how the individual is made part of the group. Now, in a platoon in combat, the individual's role in the group is absolutely vital. And if you can't count on everyone in the platoon, everyone's in danger. And so the group goes through some real contortions to make sure, I mean, as Brendan said, there are guys in the platoon that straight up hate each other, but we would all die for each other. And the platoon unconsciously goes through some real contortions to make sure that not only does everyone feel that way, but that it's confirmed over and over again, it's reaffirmed over and over again, because they don't want to have to find out in a firefight that someone's having second thoughts about their commitment to the lives of everyone around them. And one of the ways they did this was with this little ritual called Blood In, Blood Out. It was the only platoon that I heard of that did this. And it basically went like this. They're up at that place. Your main concern as a person was the welfare of everyone else. It was of greater importance than your own welfare. And every single person, as far as I could tell, every single person basically operated on that principle, maybe with an occasional exception, but for the most part. And then you go on leave, and you leave that place, and you're going back to society where that's not true, where the relationships are ambiguous, and there's a whole other way of interacting with people, and things are not black and white. And you're on 18-day leave. It starts when your feet hit American soil, and it ends when your feet leave American soil. And then suddenly you're back in this weird world on this hilltop where you could really die at any moment, and like I almost did when the bullet hit next to my head. And that transition back to this sort of narcissistic, from the sort of narcissistic, like, way that most people go, at least mildly narcissistic way that most people go through their lives in society, back to the way you have to act in a situation like Restrepo, that's a difficult transition. That's not something people do naturally. And the way they symbolized that transition was when you left Restrepo, unless you had a bullet in you, when you left Restrepo to go on leave, you got blooded out, which meant that you got the platoon grabbed you, held you down, and beat you. They didn't beat you to break any bones. They didn't beat you to harm you. It was just mildly painful for a while, and then they helped you up and gave you a hug, and off you went. And after you go home on leave, you do whatever you're going to do on leave, then you come back, and you get blooded back in, and now you're part of the platoon again. I felt like it was a uniquely male way of dealing with the stresses of that situation, and it was very effective. I studied anthropology in college, and I, as far as I was concerned, I was watching the initiation rites that I'd read about all through college in tribal societies all over the world, and initiation rites that were designed to effectively communicate the same thing. Communicate to the individual that the group is more important than him and that he basically acts in the service of the group, and then to communicate to the group that, okay, you can do anything to me. I belong to you, and I'll even go through a beating for you. And I mean, and the thing is, had any of these guys said, hey, cut it out, guys, I can't deal with this, that's a pretty good indication of how that guy is going to – they would have stopped hitting him. No one did that because it was really quite a mark of respect to go through this. But had someone really reacted badly, they would have stopped. But they would never have trusted that guy in a firefight again. And that's an important piece of knowledge in a place that had casualties, the casualty rate that those guys did. I divided my book into three sections: fear, killing, and love. They were the three emotional experiences of combat as I understood them. As a journalist, I had to sort of negotiate with my own fear. Fear is not something that's going to – it's part of the job of being a war reporter or a soldier, obviously. It's not going to just go away. You need to establish a relationship with it. It's not going to disappear, but you need a relationship with it that you're in control of. If it's in control of the relationship, things aren't going to go very well. Killing was not something I had to deal with, but it was an important issue out there. The fighting was at usually considerable distances, so they almost never saw the enemy, much less the bodies of the enemy. But they knew that they were killing other human beings out there, and I think most people have a natural revulsion to that. I think it's very hard for the average person to be okay with that, unless those people are trying to kill your friends. And at that point, the connection between the men in the platoon, essentially the love, I don't think it's a mistaken use of the word, enables men to deal with their fear. And it enables them to do something, to kill, something that they ordinarily probably would not want to be doing. It's what that connection, that love is what that makes the rest of it possible, which is what makes the rest of it psychologically manageable. I read a lot of old study. The military studied courage. They've studied fear, obviously. It's the, it's an essential component. I mean, it's if you can't manage your own fear, if there's no courage, basically combat's impossible. And so the Army has tried to figure out, how does this stuff work? Why do people get scared? People get scared, I mean, this is what they found in their studies, people get scared doesn't depend on the level of danger so much as the level of perceived control. So if you're a really well-trained unit, in a huge amount of combat, you have less fear than a poorly trained unit that is in very little danger. So often PTSD is worse on rear bases where there's an occasional mortar attack that comes out of the blue and there's no way to predict it or protect yourself from it. There's more PTSD in that kind of situation than frontline combat units that have high casualty rates, but they feel in control, relatively in control of their environment. When you drive, you're in way more danger than when you're in an airplane, but you feel that you're in control, and so it doesn't feel as scary. It's very much like that. So one of these studies from World War II, it was about courage, and basically what they found was that courage essentially was unit cohesion. It essentially was the part of my book that I call love. That's what courage, that's basically, when you say courage, you're talking about that. If you talk to soldiers about courage, it's a very frustrating conversation because they don't really, at least the ones I talk to, don't really acknowledge it. I mean, if you run through gunfire to, pull your buddy to safety after he's been wounded, a civilian would say, oh my God, that was so brave. To a soldier, the reaction would be like, well, it's not brave, that's being a soldier. Like, anything less, I wouldn't be a soldier. It's a matter of definition, not a matter of courage or cowardice. And furthermore, even if it wasn't a matter of definition in terms of being a soldier, it's a matter of definition in terms of being a friend. I mean, your kid runs into traffic and you sprint out there to grab him, save him from getting hit, you're not being courageous, you're just being a parent. You're not thinking, I could have been hit by a car. It's not really the point. That's how it is with soldiers, with many soldiers. So it's quite hard to ask them about courage because they'll deny it. They'll just say, no, I wasn't brave. I mean, Medal of Honor, guys who have won the Medal of Honor will deny it. They'll just say, no, I was just doing my job, and anyone in that platoon would have done exactly what I did. So anyway, this one study that I found, there were guys who were wounded in World War II and brought back to a rear base hospital. And they would literally go AWOL. They would crawl out windows and go AWOL from the hospital in order to make their way back to the front line to find their unit faster than the military would allow them to, because they were so worried about what was happening to their brothers out there. They were so worried that somehow, at a crucial moment, their platoon would need them, and they weren't there because they were wounded, and someone was going to get killed because at that moment they weren't there to help. And that thought was so anguishing to these wounded soldiers in World War II that they would go AWOL just to get out there so that whatever the torments of combat, it was apparently not as bad as the torments of wondering if something you did or were not doing resulted in the death of a friend. That seemed to be the ultimate hell, and something that the men would absolutely risk their lives to avoid. I'm going to read another short section, and then I'd be happy to take questions after that. And I'm going to bring Tom up to help me with the questions. So you can ask him, or you can ask me, or you can ask both of us. But hold on. Let me just read you this one section. One night a few weeks later, I'm sitting on the ammo hooch listening to the monkeys in the peaks. A temperature inversion has filled the valley with mist, and the mist is silver in the moonlight and almost liquid. Airborne was the platoon dog. They named him Airborne because the unit that was following them into the valley was the first ID, the first infantry division, regular infantry unit in the Army known as Legs, as opposed to Airborne, who can jump out of airplanes. They were Legs. They had to walk everywhere. As you can probably guess, Airborne looks down on Legs. So the idea, the joke about Airborne was that, Airborne was staying at Restrepo. So when the first ID came in, for the next 15 months, the first ID guys, every time they called their dog, they'd be reminded of their own endless inferiority to the Airborne. Airborne is asleep, but keeps popping his head up to growl at some threat impossibly far below us in the valley. There's been a big fight over by the Pakistan border, and F-15s and 16s have been powering overhead all evening, looking for people to kill. O'Byrne wanders out, and we start talking. His head is shaved, but dirt sticks to the stubble, so you can see where his hair ought to be. He says he signed a contract with the Army that's almost up, and he has to figure out whether to reenlist. Combat is such an adrenaline rush, he says. I'm worried I'll be looking for that when I get home, and if I can't find it, I'll just start drinking and getting in trouble. People back home think we drink because of the bad stuff, but it's not true. We drink because we miss the good stuff. O'Byrne is also worried about being alone. He hasn't been out of earshot of his platoon mates for 2 years and has no idea how he'll react to solitude. He's never had to get a job, find an apartment, or arrange a doctor's appointment because the Army has always done those things for him. All he's had to do is fight, and he's good at it. So leading a patrol up 1705 causes him less anxiety than, say, moving to Boston and finding an apartment and a job. He has little capacity for what civilians refer to as life skills. For him, life skills literally keep you alive. Those are far simpler and more compelling than the skills required at home. In the Korangal, almost every problem could get settled by getting violent faster than the other guy, O'Byrne told me. Do that at home, and it's not going to go so well. It's a stressful way to live, but once it's blown out your levels, almost everything else looks boring. O'Byrne knows himself. When he gets bored, he starts drinking and getting into fights, and then it's only a matter of time until he's back in the system. If that's the case, he might as well stay in the system, a better one, and actually move upward. I suggest a few civilian jobs that offer a little adrenaline. Wilderness trip guide, firefighter, but we both know it's just not the same. We are at one of the most exposed outposts in the entire U.S. military, and he's crawling out of his skin because there hasn't been a good firefight in a week. How do you bring a guy like that back into the world? One day, there hadn't been a fight in a week or two. It was very hot, and I was spacing out and sitting there working on my notes or something, and the lieutenant walked by muttering. He didn't even see me. He was muttering under his breath. I overheard him say, "Oh, God, please, someone shoot at us today." Pretty amazing. That's how boring it was out there. Civilians balk at recognizing that one of the most traumatic things about combat is having to give it up. War is so obviously evil and wrong that the idea that there could be anything good to it almost feels like a profanity. And yet throughout history, men like Mack and Rice and O'Byrne have come home to find themselves desperately missing what should have been the worst experience of their lives. to a combat vet, the civilian world can seem frivolous and dull, with very little at stake and all the wrong people in power. These men come home and quickly find themselves getting berated by a rear-base major who's never seen combat or arguing with their girlfriend about some domestic issue they don't even understand. When men say they miss combat, it's not that they actually miss getting shot at. You'd have to be deranged. It's that they miss being in a world where everything is important and nothing is taken for granted. They miss being in a world where human relations are entirely governed by whether you can trust the other person with your life. It's such a pure, clean standard that men can completely remake themselves in war. You could be anything back home, shy, ugly, rich, poor, unpopular, and it won't matter because it's of no consequence in a firefight and therefore of no consequence, period. The only thing that matters is your level of dedication to the rest of the group, and that is almost impossible to fake. That is why the men say such impossibly vulgar things about each other's sisters and mothers. It's one more way to prove nothing can break the bond between them. It's one more way to prove they're not alone out there. War is a big and sprawling word that brings a lot of human suffering into the conversation, but combat is a different matter. Combat is the smaller game that young men fall in love with, and any solution to the human problem of war will have to take into account the psyches of these young men. For some reason, there is a profound and mysterious gratification to the reciprocal agreement to protect another person with your life, and combat is virtually the only situation in which that happens regularly. These hillsides of loose shale and holly trees are where the men feel not most alive, that you can get skydiving, but the most utilized, the most necessary, the most clear and certain and purposeful. If young men could get that feeling at home, no one would ever want to go to war again, but they can't. So here sits Sergeant Brendan O'Byrne, 1 month before the end of deployment, seriously contemplating signing back up. "I prayed only once in Afghanistan," O'Byrne wrote me after it was all over. "It was when Restrepo got shot, and I prayed to God to let him live. But God, Allah, Jehovah, Zeus, or whatever a person may call God, wasn't in that valley. Combat is the devil's game. God wanted no part. That's why our prayers weren't answered. The only one listening was Satan." Before I bring Tom up, I just want to say I've had this sort of interesting idea. One of the frustrations, I think, for the soldiers is that it's so hard to communicate with the public. They are fighting for you. Whether you agree with the war or not, in their mind, they are fighting for you. There is no way to communicate with you without going through the media. That's essentially the avenue of communication between soldiers and civilians. And it's an important one, but it's not, it doesn't do the whole job. And so I had this idea that if you read my book, there'll be people like Brendan and the other guys in the platoon who might interest you. You might have questions for them about what they're doing now. Half the platoon is back in Kunar province fighting again. They're out there. Guys in my book are back out there. You might have questions for them or concerns or, you know, what when in the book on page 32 when you said that to that other guy, why did you say that? Whatever it is. I've asked them if they're willing to take questions from you, take questions in the form of emails. And they have things to say as well. I mean, they're out there doing this, and they're in a big vacuum. They talk to their wives or their families, and that's it. But this war really is about the whole country, and these guys are coming home someday. And they're coming home whether you are for the war or against it. It doesn't matter. They're coming home to this country. And all of us, left wing, right wing, pro, against, whatever, all of us are going to have to help them rejoin the society in a productive and peaceful way. And I think one of the ways to do that, I think one of the impediments to it is that their experience is often viewed by civilians, both conservative and liberal. Their experience is seen through a political prism, sometimes a moral prism. It's seen in political or moral terms. But they had an experience that really wasn't necessarily political or moral. It was just an experience, an emotional one, that affected them tremendously. And I feel that the more understanding that the public has about the emotional experience that they had, the easier it's going to be to bring these guys back. It's confusing to come home and to find yourself missing something that was that terrible. It's truly confusing to these guys. And if the public starts to have some idea about what it was out there that made sense to these men, that suddenly doesn't make sense in society, if you can understand that a little bit, I think it's going to be a much easier task to bring these people home. And so, on my website, SebastianYounger.com, really simple, SebastianYounger.com, there's a lot of interesting stuff on the website. I'm posting blogs every few days about what's going on in Afghanistan now, about guys in the book, whatever comes to my mind every few days. There's a lot of forums where soldiers write things, or wives of soldiers. There's lots of issues on the website. There's photos, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of interesting stuff. But there's also a way to, on the left-hand side of the website, there's a way to contact 2nd Platoon. Not every guy in the platoon has signed up for this. Probably about 12, 15 of them have. And you could essentially click on their name and send them an email. What I would say, though, is ask them about their experience. I don't think they really want to have a political conversation. It's not fair to them. That's not where their minds are at. Maybe they'll have those conversations later when they come home. That's their choice. But don't introduce that into the dialogue with them, because you might upset them, and there's no sense in that. So, but anything else about what they're doing, who they are, what it's like out there, go for it, because they want to hear from you. So it's really been great talking to you tonight, and I'd like to bring up my friend Tom Hunter, please. Thank you. So if you have say who you have a question for, either me or Tom, and wait for the microphone. And all right, who's got the first question? Yes, sir.
I don't care who answers it, but how's Brendan making out in civilian life? Does he have a job? He's going to school, or he's not making out so good?
Brendan's wife is in the Marines, and she's coming back in a couple months, and they're not sure where they're going to live, so he's floating a little bit right now. He's working in a town near where I live, and he's just waiting for her to come home. He's doing okay. I mean, he really crashed after the deployment. Not entirely because of the deployment. He went into that with a lot of baggage of his own. But he's doing really well right now, actually. Yes, miss, right there.
You've been a war correspondent for a very long time. You've experienced a lot of things. I was curious if you had come away with anything or one thing that you had learned that you didn't know before. I mean, obviously you've learned things and you know things, but from this particular experience, did you happen to learn something that you didn't know before?
Yeah, I mean, not to sort of reiterate a similar point, but as a reporter, I've been in, you know, Liberia and Sierra Leone and Bosnia. Dealing with fear, you're always on your own in those countries. You're a lone person, or maybe with a photographer, in a country that's in chaos. It's very, very frightening. And the fear is really sometimes pretty hard to deal with. What I did not know is that fear in a group is a very different experience. And if it's a group you feel strongly included in, the fear, it's almost an anesthetic, that group inclusion is almost an anesthetic. To the point where I wasn't, it was something that I had to deal with much, much less. And I feel like I had a little bit of an insight into human psychology. We really are social animals. And when being alone and scared in some ways, in terms of, I think, human evolution, is a very, it's kind of a rare and unnatural thing, and far more common, I think, in human history has been being scared in a group. and it's a far more manageable experience. Do you have any feelings about that?
Just one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, that you learn not only about each other, but you learn a lot about yourself out there too. I think you learn more about yourself, like Sebastian said, when you actually come home and you can take that experience and more or less what happens after that. I mean, that's the real trouble that a lot of guys are facing. A lot of my friends, including Brendan, that are, you know, we're facing that problem. You know, you get back and it's like you just explained to you, you know, I mean, it's like my dad asked me before we came in here, asked me if I was nervous. And I was like, yeah. You know, I'm nervous when I get out of bed in the morning, you know, because you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And as far as missing it, he's absolutely correct in saying so. I mean, Brendan nailed that on the head. excuse me. Here you are now, myself, for example. You know, you pay rent at the end of every month, try to get good grades in school, and you know, you are miles away from Afghanistan. And when I was in Afghanistan, I used to have, like, these really vivid dreams about being home, you know, and being surrounded by my mom, my dad, and my brothers, and just the overall, you know, feeling you have when you're home, you know, like, whether you live, away or you study abroad and you come back, you just know that it's home. And, I mean, just last night, you know, I had a dream that I was in Afghanistan, you know, and it felt like I was in Afghanistan. So it's just the roles are switched, and, you know, you have to learn to deal with that. So you really do learn a lot about yourself. That's one thing that you can pull away from that.
Yes, sir. I'll get the back next question. Oh. Sorry.
Well, my question is for the soldier. Is a bad egg ever assigned to a unit and somebody who just won't fit in? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Oh, yeah, sir. That's definitely the case. We've had our fair share of, squad leaders and things of that nature. They'll come in. One, for example, that I know offhand. I won't mention any names. But, yeah, 173 is pretty good about weeding out the how can I put this without – making it derogatory.
You can make it derogatory.
We call them shitbags, basically. it's somebody that just doesn't, they can't hack it, or they can't, they just can't assimilate, you know, and it's really physically demanding work. It's really mentally demanding, you know, but you'll get your guys in there that are not up to par, we'll say. And, you know, you just do your best to weed them out. You don't support them in anything, really. And usually you can get them out of the unit before the deployment, which is important because then your life, you know, is at stake. And sometimes you don't, but, that wasn't my first deployment, so I knew kind of how to get around that kind of stuff.
Back of the room there? Yeah, in the light blue shirt there? Either... You can both ask.
I have two questions. One is for Tom. I know Tom personally. He's an extraordinary photographer. I've seen some of his work. Are you still working on that?
Yeah, here and there. Nothing too forthcoming. Actually, Sebastian and I had kind of laid the groundwork for something in New York, but that remains still in the future. But, yeah, I'm working on it.
That's good to know. You are a talented young man.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you're brave standing up there as well.
Thank you. I think my girlfriend will agree.
The other question is for our author, and that is there's been some research that about brain mapping and psychotherapy where when you've got a pathology or a trauma of some kind, psychotherapy tends to, over a period of time, remap your brain into health. And it occurred to me when you were talking about the way these young men are exposed to extreme danger and extreme deprivation for a long period of time. I wonder has anyone looked at the notion of kind of reverse psychotherapy? I mean, essentially, their brains are being remapped in a very negative way. And maybe one of the ways has anyone looked at that in a serious way? Does anybody know?
Probably. I I didn't do a lot of research into PTSD. I mean, the scope of my book really took place, 99% of it took place inside that deployment inside the valley. So I didn't really look that much into PTSD. They're doing a lot of research on it now. Someone's probably looked at that, but I couldn't tell you more about it. Yes?
When you saw the working with the soldiers and you saw the how they were reacting to their reaction to war and the constant combat, how was the reaction of the Afghan population, which has been at war for the last 30 years? Did you notice, I guess it would be for both of you, or for both of you since you were both in Afghanistan.
All right, since over here, I'll start and then you can. Afghanistan as a country has been at war, but not every single valley and every single family has been fighting. I mean, there was a huge refugee population. But war is a strange thing, and you can be very close to a front line and not even know it. You can be in a country at war and be in a very peaceful part of it. Afghanistan has gone through a lot in the past 30 years, really very little of it of its own choosing. In the Korangal Valley, they're very, very tough people in there. The Taliban really never made any headway in there. The Russians never did. I didn't get the feeling that that fighting was something that the local people were particularly psyched to be doing. They're poor people, and they need to grow their food, and they have the same ambitions in life that most people have. They want to have a family, have children, have their good health. I mean, they're just people, they're people like us. But there are a lot of forces that converge on this valley and suck those people into combat. And one of them was poverty, frankly. I mean, the leaders of the local Taliban cells would hire local guys $5 a day to fight. And it wasn't even really fighting. They would shoot they would shoot off a magazine of AK and run back to their village. But it was part of the process out there. And then there was guys, real professionals, foreign fighters that came in from Pakistan, Arabs and Chechens, who were really very, fighting was what they were going to do, and they wanted to kill Americans, and it was very, very focused thing that they were constructing their whole lives around. So it's hard to generalize about war, and it's very, very hard to generalize about the Taliban because those terms really include a huge, huge breadth of experience and of people. You want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, as far as fighting went in the Korangal and in southern Afghanistan, I was there too, two years prior to that. And it's kind of interesting, actually, because here is this whole god-awful conflict going on in these people's backyard, and they still get up every morning, at the crack of dawn and carry on like there's nothing going on. And, that's kind of what I tried to show with most of my photographs, is that had there been no conflict in Afghanistan, which, if there's any former hippies in the room, I mean, like, Kabul was the place to be in, like, the 70s, it was just beautiful. And there are parts of Afghanistan that are just still really beautiful. I mean, Sebastian can probably attest to it as well. The locals didn't, they weren't really all about, the fighting so much in their backyard. But it really didn't hinder them from carrying out their daily life, which in actuality, like, I found that sort of, I respected that about them, if you started a conflict in the middle of, New York City, it would either be squashed right away or you'd have a bunch of pissed off New Yorkers not having that, So they did their best to just kind of stay out of the way for the most part. But, like he said, they were poor. And if the Taliban would offer them money to fight, they would, because we're obviously not going to offer them money to fight the Taliban. It was a little different on our part. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Do either of you have any experience that would indicate that women would behave differently in such a situation?
It's all yours, man.
Okay. I can speak from experience. I take it you mean, the taboo subject of women not being allowed to fight in the infantry, or?
Mr. Younger spoke about, I guess you could call it a bonding process.
Mm-hmm.
Would women or have women participated in a similar or the same kind of process?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure of it. I mean, there's women all throughout the armed forces, and I don't know of that specific instance because there are no women in the infantry, sadly. But I honestly couldn't answer that. I thought you were speaking about something else. Do you have any insight?
Look, I'm a civilian. I'm coming from outside the military. I think women would fit into a combat role quite easily in an infantry unit, but I think there's some really important issues. One of them, frankly, is privacy. There was no privacy up there. There was absolutely none. And I think at Restrepo, at the bigger bases there is, and I think it's easier to incorporate women, but at Restrepo there was absolutely no privacy, and I think it would have been psychologically extremely hard for, in that group of 30 men, for there to be one or two women living in such great proximity with so little privacy to those guys. I think it would just be very hard. It would be a very lonely year for them. And also, it's incredibly physically hard. Very few men can carry the loads that these guys were carrying. I mean, on multi-day operations, there were guys carrying 150, 160 pounds on their back in steep mountains, starting at 5,000 feet, going up to 10,000 feet in extreme heat. The outer limits of what the human body can do. And I think there are very few men who could do that. There's even fewer women who could do that. So for real, like, grunt infantry in a place like the Korngal, I think it would be very, very complicated to insert a couple of women in each platoon, essentially to make a point. If you had an entire platoon of women, I mean, that's an interesting idea, but then I think frankly, society would really balk at that for a lot of very ancient sort of social reasons, so. Yes, right there. I would the guy in front. I'll get you next. Yes, sir. Go ahead. Yeah.
Do you feel that the military prepared you for your deployment?
Yeah.
Not only the physical aspect, the mental aspect. How to endure.
They do a pretty good job making sure you know which end of your gun is the business end. They did a really good job. It's like you hear it a lot, but, there's a lot of cops, firefighters included, they'll tell you when things go south, they relied heavily or strictly on the training that they received simply because that's what will save their life, there is a basis that the Army can give you. They cannot prepare you for every aspect of combat. There's just no way, But if you're getting attacked from the left, you know how to react. If you're getting attacked from the right, the front, the rear, you know how to react. You get down. That's step one. So after that, so that's pretty good preparation, I would say. Get down. mentally, nothing can prepare you for that, really. I remember being in basic training. I was like 18, 136 pounds, carrying, rucksacks in Georgia, not Afghanistan. And, that broke me down. And then I went to Iraq, and then I went to Afghanistan, and then I went to Afghanistan again. So it was just kind of, piling on top of how much you could actually take mentally. And you don't really realize the limit that you're at until you actually leave those places and try to assimilate back into society, because you're around a bunch of people who have just experienced the same exact thing as you, if not more, usually not less. You know, when that's all gone, who do you talk to? You know, you don't talk to your best friend, you know, that works, you know, at KFC about, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder issue that you're having, because he's not going to understand. Moreover, you probably don't feel comfortable about that because you don't want your friend to think that you're some kind of, you know, burden or something like that, which I know I do it, you know. But, they do a decent job preparing you physically, mentally. You just got to prepare yourself.
Tom, I have a question for you, actually. It just occurred to me. Do you think that PTSD, that the Purple Heart should be given for PTSD or not?
Hmm.
Did you guys hear what I... Yeah? If the Purple Heart should be given for PTSD or not?
Wow. That's a good question. You know, I honestly couldn't answer because... You know, I suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't think that I deserve the Purple Heart, no. I can speak on behalf of myself and myself only. There's a bunch of people out there that are missing arms, legs, you know, eyes burned badly that have earned their Purple Heart and probably suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder as well, I'd imagine. And, me, no. I don't deserve it, but some people probably do. I think that it might be a good idea to look into something like that.
I was just curious because there was a debate a while ago. There was a debate about that. Yes, ma'am, right there. Last one. Okay.
Have you had any of the same adjustment problems that soldiers have had, or did your writing help you to get through it?
Did I have the same problems? I mean, a little bit, I think. I mean, if you're in combat, and this wasn't just in Afghanistan. I mean, the times I've been in Africa, you come back home, and you're definitely jumpy. I mean, absolutely, in almost kind of cliched ways, you know. Something goes bang, and you jump, you know. I heard, I don't know what it was, pipes rattling or something, and I was on the floor in my apartment, and you're reacting before you even really know it. That goes away for me, it went away pretty quickly. Like, it took about a year, I'd say.
Would you have the same feeling of need to go back to be with the men that you
have? I really missed it. When I did five trips, and between trips, I really missed it out there. And, in a civilian version of what they were experiencing, absolutely. You know, one thing it also did was, and this was really interesting, I mean, not all of the repercussions of combat are negative. I mean, a lot of it is, some of it is, obviously. But there's also, I mean, for me, at any rate, I mean, I had a lot of bad dreams. I had all kinds of stuff, nothing I couldn't handle, but, you know. But I also became a much more emotional person, and I was not an emotional person before. And I felt kind of that experience out there, the good in it and the bad in it, whatever, emotionally, it opened me up in some really profound ways. And my wife noticed it. I noticed it. I'm 48 years old, better late than never. But it happened out there, and I don't know why, and it was about the last thing I would have expected. But it was one of the strange, you know, people talk about the effects of combat. The assumption is those effects are negative. A lot of them are, but not all of them are. And I think that's also is something that society, because combat's so horrible, society, I think, almost insists that anything that comes out of that has to be horrible. But actually, I think it would help these guys quite a lot to try to sort through and see what some of the positive responses were, because that's the stuff they miss. And if society can understand that and sort of be sympathetic about it, I think reentry will be a lot easier. So that was, I guess, the last question. Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.